Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Benjamin Schreiber of Friends of the Earth, who discusses the Trump administration's plan to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency through deep budget cuts and staff layoffs. Shannon Jackson, executive director of Our Revolution, a Bernie Sanders campaign offshoot, who reflects on the defeat of Keith Ellison, his group's endorsed candidate to lead the Democratic Party. And Julie Richards, an Oglala Lakota anti-pipeline activist and founder of the group Mothers Against Meth Alliance, who talks about the link between the oil industry and drug addiction plaguing indigenous communities in the Northern Plains. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 3 years of bloody civil war in South Sudan, the United Nations has declared a famine in the East African nation. 100,000 people now face the immediate threat of starvation, with 1 million more at risk for famine. The ongoing crisis has intensified since the South Sudan government blocked aid shipments to hard-hit regions in the country. Many farmers have stopped planting crops due to rising violence. Joyce Luma, South Sudan director for the World Food Program, asserted the famine is man-made. There is only so much humanitarian assistance can achieve in the absence of meaningful peace and security. The upsurge in violence that began last July undermined the planting of crops in previously peaceful and productive regions. Inflation soared to 800%, and many village markets closed. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council refused to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan, which could have reduced the violence. According to Foreign Policy magazine, now UN officials worry that without a massive influx of aid, food stocks could be empty by June. The emergency in South Sudan has triggered Africa's most serious refugee crisis, as 1.5 million people have fled across the border, seeking refuge in Uganda. President Donald Trump withdrew the United States' longstanding support of a two-state solution that many hoped would bring peace to Israel and Palestine. During a joint appearance with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump showed little interest in endorsing any formula for Middle East peace. Israeli Education Minister Naftali Bennett wants to extend Israel's sovereignty over 60% of the West Bank. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the plan calls for 80,000 Palestinians to be granted residency in the new district. Other Palestinians would be forced to live in autonomous areas under Israeli control. This is seen by many observers as a first step for Israel to formally annex the West Bank, which Palestinian and world leaders maintain would establish an official apartheid system in Israel. As the Trump administration rolls back transgender rights for students, leading American corporations like Walmart, Chevron, Apple, and General Electric have won high praise for establishing inclusionary policies toward the LGBTQ community. This comes in the face of attacks by social conservatives over so-called bathroom bills that they support in states including North Carolina and Texas. According to the Human Rights Campaign, 517 major corporations received 100% ratings in the 2017 Corporate Equality Index. It was the largest one-year jump in workplace equity for LGBTQ employees since the ratings were launched in 2002. Top employers now offer their workers transgender-inclusive health coverage. In addition, over 80% of Fortune 500 companies have adopted gender identity protections. According to the Christian Science Monitor, adopting progressive employment policies and strong stands on LGBTQ issues is a key strategy to attract creative and younger employees, as well as to boost their corporate image. Still, many transgender people fear workplace discrimination. A survey by the Center for Transgender Equality found 30% of transgender people say they were terminated or denied a promotion because of gender identity. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. We'll be right back.
Among President Trump's cabinet appointees and staff are a long list of climate change deniers and individuals with very close ties to the fossil fuel industry. The real estate billionaire and reality TV star sent a clear message to America and the world when he chose Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, a dedicated ally of the oil and gas industry, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. During his time as Oklahoma's Attorney General, he filed 14 lawsuits against the EPA, some of which are still ongoing, and he generally took a stand against many EPA air and water quality standards. On February 17th, Pruitt's nomination was approved by the U.S. Senate by a vote of 52-46. During his confirmation hearing, it came to light that Pruitt had been illegally withholding some 7,500 pages of emails. But after his confirmation, and an Oklahoma judge's ruling that forced Pruitt to release those emails, it was revealed to what extent his office had closely collaborated with the fossil fuel industry on legal strategies to undermine federal efforts to regulate carbon and greenhouse gas emissions linked to climate change. On February 28th, President Trump signed an executive order directing Pruitt and the EPA to start rolling back the Obama-era Clean Water Rule that protects water sources from pollution. Your reporter spoke with Ben Schreiber, senior political strategist with the group Friends of the Earth, who discusses his group's response to the Senate confirmation of Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, and how environmental groups plan to counter the Trump-Pruitt plan to broadly dismantle EPA regulations through deep budget cuts and staff layoffs.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that Donald Trump installed Scott Pruitt into EPA to dismantle the agency from within. And what we heard is that the outline of the budget that Trump has submitted calls for an increase in military spending by $54 billion and a cut of the EPA budget by 25%, including a 20% reduction in staff. So we're talking about a massive, massive cut of the EPA budget, which would be $6.1 billion. So, you know, we're talking about cutting a relatively small agency to boost up our defense spending, and it's a drop in the bucket compared to what we spend on defense. I think the other thing that's really come to light is that in the confirmation process, Scott Pruitt made it clear that you know, he thought that EPA had the authority and the obligation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. And the Supreme Court has ruled as much. Basically, as soon as the confirmation process was over, he gave a speech at CPAC, the conservative gathering that was happening here in Washington, and he basically raised questions about whether or not EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. And so he brought into question, you know, what has been decided in by the Supreme Court in Massachusetts versus EPA. And it's pretty clear that, you know, Donald Trump and Scott Pruitt are at least going to consider ending regulation of greenhouse gases in the United States.
That would presumably result in a court fight. Is that right?
For sure. There will definitely be a court fight. You know, also, they're talking about rolling back the Clean Power Plan, President Obama's first step to regulating emissions from power plants here in the United States.
Now, what about the Paris Climate Agreement, the international agreement that Barack Obama signed? What does it look like in terms of the Trump agenda there?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of rumblings that Donald Trump will actually remove the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. He sort of hinted as much on the campaign trail. He hasn't really made any signals about that since taking over the White House. I think there's two thoughts about this. One is that you know, he's decided that actually it's more strategic to stay within the framework and actually dismantle it from within, and that by withdrawing the United States, we will no longer be parties to the agreement, and he will have less influence over the overall process. So you know, maybe that's his tactic. The other option is he just hasn't gotten around to it yet. One thing that did happen is that the State Department announced that they're going to be sending a delegation to Bonn for the intersessional that's coming up. And so, you know, right now the U.S. is actually moving forward as if they're going to continue to participate in the Paris process.
So, Ben, as you and your colleagues in other environmental organizations around the country take stock of what the Trump administration agenda here is on the environment, what's some of the strategy that you're talking about or have actually maybe even initiated to counter what Trump is doing here?
Yeah. So I think that the first thing, and you sort of alluded to it before, is this is if this budget passes. And this budget is not going to pass without the help of Democrats, because there is an appropriations process and money for EPA will have to be appropriated. We are hoping that Senate Democrats in particular hold a strong line and stand up for clean air and clean water and make it clear that, you know, this budget is dead on arrival and that this is not a proposal that they can support. So there are leverage points that are out there. On budgeting, it's hard to use the courts, but on rolling back rules like the Clean Power Plan or other important regulations, you know, the courts are available to us. And you know, Donald Trump is not a dictator, as much as he might like to be. He cannot just roll back rules and regulations without going through the proper process. And so if he does go through the proper process, it's clear that, you know, climate science is real. Greenhouse gases are a problem. And that if the EPA is really going to follow the laws and be protective of human health, it's going to have to take into account and regulate these things. And so as he tries to avoid those obligations, you know, the courts are available to us.
That was Benjamin Schreiber, senior political strategist with Friends of the Earth. Learn more about how environmental groups are responding to President Trump's plan to dismantle the EPA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the Democratic Party was adjusting to being iced out of power in Congress and the White House under the presidency of Donald Trump, the long-awaited election of a new chair of the Democratic National Committee was held in Atlanta, Georgia, on February 25th. The two main contenders for the post were Democratic Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, a supporter of Bernie Sanders' presidential bid, and former Obama Labor Secretary Tom Perez. When Perez won the chairmanship by a vote of 235-200, there were concerns that many Sanders supporters and other progressives who had supported Ellison may choose to walk away from the party and invest their time and energy in independent political projects. But Perez, a supporter of Hillary Clinton's failed bid for the White House, immediately offered an olive branch to his opponent and his many union supporters by offering Ellison the post of deputy chair. Despite serious divisions within the party over issues such as the role of superdelegates in the nomination process, a vote that rejected extending the 8-year ban on corporate political action committee donations to the party, and continuing anger at the DNC for tilting toward Hillary in the primary campaign, Ellison joined Perez in calling for unity in opposing Donald Trump and his right-wing agenda. Your reporter spoke with Shannon Jackson, executive director of Our Revolution, a progressive political action group formed by Bernie Sanders supporters after the 2016 primary campaign. Here, Jackson reflects on the victory of Tom Perez over Our Revolution's endorsed candidate Keith Ellison for DNC chair and the challenges ahead for a party that has seen historic losses in Congress, governor's races, and state legislative seats.
It's disappointing. We really saw an incredible leader in Keith and thought he embodied exactly what we wanted the Democratic Party to become. We thought he had the transformative organizing energy that would have really brought the values that we feel the majority of the electorate that make up the Democratic Party care about. We felt that Keith is an incredible leader, and he's been an incredible leader both organizing and through his campaigning in Minnesota and on the countless of races that he's been involved with throughout the U.S., including Senator Sanders' run for president. It needs to be stated that we are very disappointed that his run was unsuccessful. But we are hopeful that Secretary Perez, now DNC Chairman Perez, will work with Keith to learn from his skills and supplement his ability to lead the party in that direction. His move to give Representative Ellison the position of deputy chair was, I hope it was it actually becomes something. Some could be said that was a consolation prize. I would hope that Keith does play a very large role in forming the new Democratic Party and something that our supporters in our revolution want to be a part of. Regardless of the direction the DNC takes, I'm actually very worried where it goes after the vote it took before the DNC chair was elected. There was a vote about accepting large corporations' monies and donations. It was a ban that had been lifted after 8 years of being in place under the Obama administration. It was voted upon by the same members that then elected Perez to reinstate it. That does concern me. It does not show me that they are learning from what works and what doesn't work. Our supporters of our revolution really are concerned with where money comes from, who we answer to. Our revolution is proud to have a full disclosure policy and not take any corporate money, and we would wish that the DNC followed suit that same standards. But I really do encourage people to get involved locally. I think that we were looking at the DNC race in a two-part strategy. We had the how are we going to transform the Democratic Party? We were supporting Keith on top. That was our top-down approach. And then we had the bottom-up approach, which we're still actively engaged with, in which when every state over the next 2 years, as they reorganize their state party for the DNC, there are state party elections and there are precinct races on every level for people to get involved with. I think in total, there's something like 6,800 positions that people can run for locally to be involved on the local level of their Democratic Party and make the Democratic Party something they are proud of.
Shannon, of the many serious issues that the Democratic Party confronts now, where they no longer have control of any branch of the federal government, have lost a majority of governor's seats, and over the past 8 years lost nearly 1,000 legislative seats in state legislatures across the country. What are some of the big issues that you think the party needs to confront internally before they can really tackle the major issues of the all-important message to people around the country as to why Democrats should be trusted with positions of power and decision-making?
That's a great question. I think if you look at the country right now, as you said, we've lost over 1,000 seats nationwide at local levels. We do not have, I think the Republicans are just a few governorships away from being able to have a constitutional convention, which they could completely rule this country in directions that we would not want to live under. And it's scary. It's disappointing. It's a huge red flag that the Democratic Party has not been receptive or hearing the people's needs and relating to the working class Americans and giving them a reason to vote for them. I think they need to take a hard look at their message and see how they can attract the working class Americans back to their party. They have these listening tours that they showcase as they go around and listen to the people that are actually living in their communities. I think they should be more than just a show of face. I think they should really listen to their constituents. I think they need to understand that the minimum wage and the progressive platform that we crafted after the election is exactly the direction people need to head. The Democrats have a very good social platform. They have all the great talking points of bringing people together, of rallying around the social issues that on a large swath basis, you could say the Republicans are very divisive. The Democrats are meant for people to come to them. They should have everyone racing to them, and they should be the ones in power, but they are not. And they have to take a long look at what are the issues that are actually resonating with people. I believe they are the issues of economics and the platform that Senator Sanders ran on. The majority of things the senator spoke about were the issues, and the issues that meant the most to people were what they were viewing in their everyday life, whether it was healthcare, whether it was family leave, whether it was something that affected them today in the workplace, a paycheck. The Democratic Party needs to find those values and run on them and talk to the people.
That was Shannon Jackson, executive director of Our Revolution, a progressive political action group formed by Bernie Sanders supporters after the 2016 primary campaign. Learn more about Our Revolution and find more analysis on the outcome of the election for DNC chair by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Julie Richards is an Oglala Lakota woman who grew up on one of the Sioux reservations that dot North and South Dakota. As a water protector, she was the first woman to lock herself down to oil drilling machinery as Energy Transfer Partners was building the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The pipeline is heading toward completion as the company, with the blessing of the Trump administration, drills under the Missouri River to complete the more than 1,100-mile project that indigenous people call the Black Snake. Richards was recently on an East Coast tour with members of the Red Warrior Society, talking about the ongoing fight to stop the pipeline. She also spoke about a group she founded years earlier called MAMA, or Mothers Against Meth Alliance. Methamphetamine, also known as crystal meth or simply meth, is a highly addictive stimulant that can be smoked, injected, inhaled, or taken by mouth. Richards was moved to act after her daughter got caught up in meth addiction, a scourge in Native communities in the Dakotas that exploded when so-called man camps were built to bring in oil extraction and pipeline workers. Already plagued by high rates of alcoholism and suicide, people living on reservations in the Northern Plains now face the potentially deadly threat of meth addiction. As part of the tour, Julie Richards gave a talk at the Unitarian Society of Hartford, Connecticut on February 6th. The following excerpts from Richards' nearly hour-long discussion were recorded and produced by Between the Lines Melinda Tuhus.
Do any of you know about the man camps? Yeah, a lot of people don't know about it. So wherever there's oil industry or mining, the workers there are all men. The ones that come in, they're men, especially the pipelines. And they set up camps. Wherever they're setting the pipelines up, they'll set up camps there. And a lot of them are already into drugs because they need those drugs to stay up all night. When we were at camp, those lights were on all night. They work all night. As you know, I told those cops, they're not staying up all night like that with just coffee. They're on meth. They're doing meth. And they set up so close to the reservations. They usually recruited one Indian man to work for them. And then they use him to recruit the Native women from the tribe. They use him to introduce the tribe to the drugs. And now it's heroin. My tribe still wants to into the meth epidemic, but a lot of other tribes are into the heroin now. That's coming from these man camps. And they mix the heroin with the meth, and that's even more dangerous. And so it's mostly men, and so then they start sex trafficking. They need the women, and if there's not that many women, they turn to the young boys. They'll recruit a young boy to go into their camp to do different odd jobs, and then they end up using him for sex. And that's the type of stuff that our Native women deal with when there's oil industry, is the sex violence, and it's all connected. The oil industry, the pipelines, the man camps, the meth and heroin, the sex trafficking, and it leads to the missing and murdered indigenous women. You know, it's all connected and nobody really knows that. So that was my fight there. That was my fight at Standing Rock. So not only are they desecrating Mother Earth and poisoning our water, our sisters are disappearing. Our daughters are disappearing at a high rate, but the cops prefer to protect the pipeline. Every time I come across, face-to-face fighting with the meth dealer, what they don't know is that it's not just me they're fighting against. That's why they can't harm me. My ancestors are surrounding me. At Sundance, my ancestors vowed to be with me in this fight against meth and to keep me safe, and they have. There's so many times I could have been killed, but my ancestors saved me. I started going into the jail. The jail contacted me and asked me if I'd go in and do meth awareness and education with the men and women in jail. So I did. So my very first one was with the women. The second one was with the men, and it was all the meth dealers that I had been fighting with that had threatened to kill me. I probably threatened to kill them too, but I came face to face with them and I started telling them, my perspective on it, coming from a mother's perspective on it, from seeing my daughter so high that she was freaking out and seeing things. My ancestors are stronger than you, you mess period, you know, you're, you, you don't got me, you know, because it doesn't and it never will. You know, it tries to attack me in different ways than people. You know, at first I thought I was going crazy because I'd be ready to go out and do a myth awareness or a walk and rally, and I'd have my phone on the charger all night, and I'd get to the place where we're going to walk and my phone will be dead. Or we'll get done with the presentation and my car will be dead. One time we went to another reservation and did a walk and rally there. That was the first one that they ever had. And when we were ready to leave, all four of our cars were dead. And the people there were like, gee, what? Did you guys all leave your radio on? I was like, no, that's just not, you know, that's that mess spirit. So that's why I'm always smudging. We smudge down before we come in here. But, you know, when I'm done talking about it or whatever, I smudge down again because, you know, it thinks I'm giving it attention, but I'm not. You know, I'm still fighting against it because I'm bringing that awareness about it. And I'll keep fighting until the day I die. I'll keep fighting against this drug because I see the devastation. I see my beautiful daughter turn into somebody that she wasn't. I'd sit up with her for days. I'd be tired. I'd doze off, but I'd get up with her because I didn't want her to be up by herself because she became suicidal. And now suicide is another evil spirit that goes hand in hand with it, along with alcohol. Alcohol is also one of my fights now. I fight against that liquid genocide. I fight against meth. I fight for the water. I fight for the land. You know, I refuse to be a victim of boarding school trauma. I refuse to be a victim of sexual assault, child sexual abuse. I refuse to be a victim of spouse abuse. I refuse to be a victim of alcohol abuse, and I refuse to be a victim of drug abuse. I'm a survivor. I'm a warrior.
That was Julie Richards, founder of the group Mothers Against Meth Alliance. Learn more about groups combating meth addiction in Indigenous communities by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.